Our guest speaker this morning is Robert Revington, and Robert is from Aurora, and he is a PhD student, first year at Knox College at the University of Toronto, and he's a fan of the Tiger Cats. That's one of his interests. And also, an interesting thing was in high school at his graduation, he wore a Superman costume. And it was underneath his graduation gown, and when the grad was over, he revealed Superman. So we're excited to have you speak with us today.
Before I begin, I would like to thank all of you for the welcome today and the opportunity to come here. I'd like to thank Pastor Rick for giving me this opportunity, as well as Jacqueline, Kayla, and Victoria for leading worship, and Maureen, Marcos, Lena, Gary, Judy, and anyone else I may be forgetting for helping to make this possible. Lawrence Chatterton, who is one of the translators of the King James Bible, was once invited to give a sermon in a church. He preached on the Bible for over 2 hours straight, and finally paused and said that he would no longer trespass on their patience. Nonetheless, his audience cried out, "For God's sake, sir, go on, go on." They made him preach even longer. We will see if this discussion today leaves all of you similarly riveted. Anyway, as you've heard, for most of my life, I've been a fan of the Hamilton Tiger Cats of the Canadian Football League. This past year, I went to all of their home games, preseason, regular season, and playoffs, as well as 3 away games. And most of the games I didn't attend, I got to see in pristine high definition. But it wasn't always like that. When I was younger, there were many games I didn't get to see, and some that weren't even televised. I often had to get my image of the football game from the radio. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes, even though I couldn't see what was happening, nonetheless, I got a clear signal and could follow what the announcer was describing quite easily. But other times, there might be away games out west, and the signal wasn't so clear. The radio would come through garbled, and despite my fumbling attempts to better tune the station, there would be buzzing or high-pitched distortions in the signal. It would fade in and out. I can recall a game against Winnipeg in 2001 where the radio announcer proclaimed that Hamilton had gotten a game-winning touchdown, only to lose the signal. When the signal returned a few minutes later, it turned out that the receiver had bobbled the ball into the hands of an opposing defensive player and had been intercepted, and they had lost the game. Or I would hear some of the game, but at the same time, I could hear an ad jingle from another radio station coming through, something like, "Call 1-800-267-2001. Alarm, force," and had to really focus to understand what was happening. And then finally, sometimes I would get nothing. Nothing but static. Faith is like that sometimes. As Jesus said to Thomas, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." But we, all of us in this room, are those who have not seen. Sometimes faith comes through with a loud and clear signal, even though we can't see it. But sometimes, metaphorically speaking, it doesn't, or there's other stations getting in the way, other distractions in our lives. And finally, sometimes it feels like we're listening to the radio, but nothing's coming through from the other place. And what are we to do about it? In Kathleen Norris's 1998 book, Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith, Norris recalls some advice she received at a Benedictine abbey she liked to visit. Let me read to you some of what Norris wrote, as she says, "I was surprised to find the monks so unconcerned with my weighty doubts and intellectual frustrations over Christianity. What interested them more was my desire to come to their worship, the liturgy of the hours. I was a bit disappointed. I had thought that my doubts were spectacular obstacles to my faith and was confused but intrigued when an old monk blithely stated that doubt is merely the seed of faith, a sign that faith is alive and ready to grow. I am grateful now for his wisdom and grateful for the community for teaching me about the power of liturgy. They seemed to believe that if I just kept coming back to worship, kept coming home, things would eventually fall into place." I soon learned that the fledgling joys that came to me on rare occasions in the Abbey choir, when a psalm would seem to speak to me, or when a hymn and gospel reading would coalesce with my random thoughts in a striking way, were harder to sustain when I was at home trying to pray alone, or with the Presbyterian congregation whose services I'd begun to attend. Despite all of the encouragement the monks were giving me, it took me a long time to recognize that the desire to worship is in itself a significant form of belief. In other words, for Norris, just showing up to worship helped it sink in. But again, it is easy to lose the signal. One example of this is Charles Templeton. In the first half of the 20th century, Templeton was a popular Christian evangelist, one who was on track to rival his good friend Billy Graham. In the 1940s, Templeton traveled on evangelistic tours all over the world alongside Graham. But in 1957, he publicly announced he had lost his faith and even became quite outspoken about being a non-believer, the opposite of his previous life. Near the end of his life, he wrote a book called Farewell to God, My Reasons for Rejecting the Christian Faith. But when Templeton was in his 80s, the Christian author Lee Strobel interviewed him for a book, and Templeton said something that shocked Strobel. Even though Templeton still did not believe, he declared that Jesus was the most important human being who ever existed. Then, let me read Strobel's account of what Templeton said about Jesus next. As Strobel writes, "That's when Templeton uttered the words about Jesus I never expected to hear from him. And, if I may put it this way," he said, as his voice began to crack, "I miss him." With that, tears flooded his eyes. He turned his head and looked downward, raising his left hand to shield his face from me. His shoulders bobbed as he wept. What was going on? Was this an unguarded glimpse into his soul? I felt drawn to him and wanted to comfort him. At the same time, the journalist in me wanted to dig to the core of what was prompting this reaction. Missed him why? Missed him how? Strobel's story ends without Templeton saying much more. But think about that. A man who wrote a book condemning Christianity wept as he recalled that he now missed Jesus, the Lord he had once prayed to and whose gospel he had preached for so many years. In some ways, what Templeton was feeling is not unlike what the disciples were feeling about Jesus after he was crucified. Only unlike Templeton, they saw the risen Lord, their friend and master, appear before them and bring them joy. But we are those who have not seen. It should be noted that there are certain prominent biblical scholars who have argued that the story of Thomas did not happen. These scholars believe that there was another sect of early Christians known as Thomas Christians, and the author of John's Gospel wanted to discredit them by showing that Thomas had less faith than he ought to. It's an interesting theory with one crucial flaw, that it has no evidence. It's based entirely on speculation and by making fanciful guesses about another text called the Gospel of Thomas that wasn't written until about a century after John's Gospel. So we can safely cast aside that idea. The disciple Thomas is colloquially known as Doubting Thomas, but he gets something of a bad rap. After all, he did not necessarily possess less faith than the other disciples. He simply wasn't there the first time Jesus appeared to them, and it's hard to fault him too much. As your pastor Rick commented to me, Thomas was the normal one. In fact, when we read the Gospel of Matthew, we notice a curious thing. Matthew 28:17 says of the disciples, "When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted." That is to say, even when they saw him right before them, they had trouble processing what they were experiencing. Thomas was not an anomaly. Back in Mark 9:24, a man wants Jesus to heal his son and makes a statement that many of us might find it easy to relate to, as he says, "I believe, help my unbelief." In the Old Testament, the Israelites saw a lot of miracles, but they complained and did not follow God. That rings true to human nature. Jesus' miracles did not persuade all of his contemporaries either. If we saw a miracle, would it make us perfect followers of Christ on the spot? I don't know if it would. Several years ago, I thought it was something of a miracle when I managed to perfectly parallel park on my driver's test. One of the last times I've ever even tried to parallel park, in fact. But it didn't produce the faith to make me a flawless Christian, even though it was a miracle. Indeed, the 18th century theologian William Law once wrote, "If you will stop here and ask yourself why you are not so devoted as the primitive Christians, your own heart will tell you that it is neither through ignorance nor inability, but purely because you never thoroughly intended it." Those are some biting words, but probably accurate for me. Now, in one of his books, the popular Christian author Philip Yancey says, "Faith means believing in advance what will only make sense in reverse." But that is easier said than done, especially when life is at its most uncertain. Frankly, sometimes things don't make sense to us. But in one of his letters, C.S. Lewis shared the following parable. Two men had to cross a dangerous bridge. The first convinced himself that it would bear them and called this conviction faith. The second said, "Whether it breaks or holds, whether I die here or somewhere else, I am equally in God's good hands." And the bridge did break. And the second man's faith was not disappointed, and the first man's was. Now, frankly, I find it easier to identify with the first man than the second most of the time, and then to feel disappointed when things don't happen as I feel they should. Yet more to the point, Yancey records a conversation he had with a man named Douglas, who gave him a helpful piece of advice. Don't confuse life with God. In other words, bad things that we can't control will happen, but we have to distinguish between them and who God is. But again, sometimes that's not easy. In Mark Twain's classic novel, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the protagonist, Huck Finn, narrates a story about what a kind old woman called Miss Watson told him. As Huck says, she told me to pray every day, and whatever I asked for, I would get it. But it weren't so. I tried it. Once I got a fish line, but no hooks. It weren't any good to me without hooks. I tried for the hooks 3 or 4 times, but somehow I couldn't make it work. By and by, one day, I asked Miss Watson to try for me, but she said I was a fool. We may say that Huck Finn did not have the right idea about prayer, but we can at least empathize with his frustrations that his prayers didn't seem to work the way he wanted. Likewise, Paul Little narrates the following anecdote. "I heard about a Christian family that prayed out loud together several times each day. One day the youngest son looked up at a picture of Jesus on the kitchen wall, stared at it, and said thoughtfully, 'Jesus, Jesus, Jesus, that's all I hear. But he don't say nothing back.'" Yet sometimes it may be easy to take for granted the good things in life, or the things that point to a benevolent God. In one of his works, the ancient philosopher Aristotle imagined what it would be like if there was a community of men who had always lived underground and never had the chance to look out at all the stars in the night sky. And Aristotle said, "If there were beings who had always lived beneath the earth, in comfortable, well-lit dwellings, decorated with statues and pictures, and furnished with all the luxuries enjoyed by persons thought to be supremely happy, and who, though they had never come forth above the ground, had learnt by report and by hearsay of the existence of certain deities or divine powers, and then if at some time the jaws of the earth were opened and they were able to escape from their hidden abode and to come forth into the regions which we inhabit, when they suddenly had sight of the earth and the seas and the sky and came to know of the vast clouds and mighty winds and beheld the sun and realized not only its size and beauty but also how it causes the day by shedding light over all the sky, and after night had darkened the earth, they then saw the whole sky spangled and adorned with stars, and the changing phases of the moon's light, now waxing and now waning, and the risings and settings of all these heavenly bodies and their courses fixed and changeless throughout all eternity. When they saw these things, surely they would think that the gods exist and that these mighty marvels are their handiwork." We can simplify Aristotle's conclusions by pointing to one God, but the point stands nonetheless. The contemporary Christian philosopher William Lane Craig observes that when Aristotle wrote his words, he lived in a world undimmed by pollution and the glare of city lights. Only if we go someplace away from the city, perhaps up north to Tobermory on the Bruce Peninsula, where I was when I first read those words, Only then can we fully appreciate what Aristotle saw and admire the vastness of the constellations above. Most of the time, perhaps we are like Aristotle's race of underground humans when they could not see the beauty of creation. More to the point, the medieval theologian St. Thomas Aquinas was fond of quoting Romans 1:20, where Paul makes a somewhat similar point. In that verse in Romans, and in the following verse, Paul says of God that, "Ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made. So they are without excuse, for though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened." There are, of course, more intellectual reasons to believe. One can point to the fact of creation or the arguments supporting the resurrection of Jesus. For why would his disciples invent such a tale? Why would they invent a story where women were among the most prominent eyewitnesses in a patriarchal culture where women were not even considered sound legal witnesses? And so on. And yet, in spite of all these things, faith still doesn't come easy for everyone all the time. C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, is told from the perspective of a demon in hell, and it tells a story of how one young man who was beginning to ponder Christianity, but then went out into the street, and, in the words of Lewis's demonic narrator, the young man saw a newsboy shouting at the midday paper and a number 73 bus going past, and before he reached the bottom of the steps, I had got into him an unalterable conviction that whatever odd ideas might come into a man's head when he was shut up alone with his books, a healthy dose of real life, by which he meant the bus and the newsboy, was enough to show him that all that sort of thing just couldn't be true. On the face of it, this sounds silly, and yet sometimes the things that take us off track are distractions like this, though not always. I'm reminded of when the British newspaper The Telegraph asked the British stage and screen actor Derek Jacobi what he thought about religion. In that interview, here was Jacobi's response. "As a teenager, I was taken to a Billy Graham rally. At the end of it, I went down to the arena to give myself to Jesus. But as soon as Graham stopped talking, it was like the choir stopped singing, and," he snaps his fingers, "I felt totally conned and embarrassed. I don't mind people having faith and finding strength in that, but it ain't for me." That was what Jacobi said. Here, we should note that Christian community is thus an important factor in reinforcing what we believe. And Jacobi's words remind us that faith should not be synonymous with emotional highs that can't possibly be sustained in all times and places. Faith is not just about our emotions in the moment. And we don't have all the answers, and can't have them. When I was in my second year of university, I was living on the 11th floor of my residence building at McMaster. I had quite an impressive view of Hamilton, and was that much closer to the sky. But for some reason, being so high up made me question the ascension of Jesus, and then other things too. I asked myself whether such a story was something told by people who just thought that heaven was a place in the sky, and whether I could believe it today. But when I focused on other larger questions, this stopped being as much of an issue, because I found I had to ask myself, well then, what did happen to Jesus' body? And since I didn't believe it was lying in a tomb, but remembered that he had spontaneously appeared and reappeared many times, the ascension stopped being so much of an issue for me. Reminding yourself of the bigger points is often helpful. It is easy to get bogged down in deep questions, but the answer is Christ, as it was for Thomas. Let me read a quote to you from one of Yancey's other books. Martin Luther encouraged his students to flee the hidden God and run to Christ. And now I know why. If I use a magnifying glass to examine a fine painting, the object in the center of the glass stays crisp and clear, while around the edges the view grows increasingly distorted. For me, Jesus has become the focal point. When I speculate about such imponderables as the problem of pain or providence versus free will, everything becomes fuzzy. But if I look at Jesus himself, at how he treated people in actual pain, at his calls to free and diligent action, clarity is restored. I can worry myself into a state of spiritual ennui over questions like, what good does it do to pray to God if God already knows everything? Jesus silences such questions. He prayed, so should we. End quote. Yet sometimes the notion of certainty, as we understand it in churches, is flawed. In 2013, the theologian Gregory A. Boyd wrote a book called Benefit of the Doubt, Breaking the Idol of Certainty. The full book is itself a good read, but I'm going to quote to you a bit of how Boyd succinctly explained the book in an interview. His book was partly inspired by a prayer meeting he attended over 20 years ago, where he and others were asked to pray for a terminally ill young man. Let me read in some detail to you an excerpt of how Boyd describes the meeting and his reflections. At the beginning of the meeting, the lady who owned the house we were in stood up and read Jesus' statement, "According to your faith, it will be done to you." She then told us that if our faith was free of doubt, this young man would be healed. The implication was that if we doubted, he would not be healed. As we entered into prayer for this young man, everyone in the room felt pressure to try to make ourselves certain that this man was in fact going to be healed. After a couple of minutes of praying, the image of the lion on the Wizard of Oz suddenly popped into my mind, and I saw him saying, "I do believe, I do believe, I do, believe," just as he does in the movie. It occurred to me that this was exactly what we were doing. We were trying to talk ourselves into becoming certain, as if faith was a sort of psychological gimmick. And it made me wonder what kind of God would leverage the life of a young man on how well we were to perform this psychological gimmickry, and about a matter that, if we're honest with ourselves, we can't be certain of. It seemed like we were caught in a cruel, twisted joke. Certainty-seeking faith is the sort of faith that people were trying to exercise in the prayer meeting. It's the assumption that a person's faith is as strong as they are free of doubt, and that striving to have a strong, viz. Doubt-free faith somehow pleases God. I found that this is how most Christians today think about faith, and it causes far more damage than most people realize. Thoughtful people legitimately wonder why God would consider this ability virtuous, to the point of leveraging people's eternal welfare on it. So too, this model makes thoughtful people who have perfectly reasonable doubts feel guilty, and rewards people who either lack the concern or the intellectual curiosity to question their beliefs by making them feel like they have strong faith. On top of this, those who embrace certainty-seeking faith tend to become narrow-minded, for honestly trying to see things from other people's point of view might lead them to question their faith and thereby jeopardize their salvation. In fact, this model can easily lead people to develop learning phobias. For if you dare to read broadly and learn to see things from other people's points of view, you might uncover facts that could shake your certainty. I'm convinced this explains why Christians, especially conservative Christians, have a well-deserved reputation in the broader culture for being narrow-minded. I end Boyd's reflections here. The point to remember is that asking questions like Thomas did isn't always bad, but it can lead us to a fuller understanding. Yet there is another thing, a challenge, if you will. Jesus said to Thomas, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." But for those who neither see nor believe, their understanding of Jesus could come from us. Let's think about that a bit. In 2009, a film called The Blind Side was released in theaters and was nominated for many awards. The movie is based on the real-life story of Michael Oher, a young African-American man who passed from foster home to foster home when he was young, often running away and living on the streets, until a woman named Lei Ann Tui, a devout Christian, adopted him into her family. With the family's love and support, Oher began to play high school football and eventually became a starting left tackle in the National Football League. This is a true story, but for the movie, Hollywood star Sandra Bullock played the part of Lei Ann. And even though Bullock eventually won a Best Actress Academy Award for her performance, she was at first reluctant to be in the film. Bullock is not a Christian and was suspicious of Christians. In an interview, she talked about this and about when she met Lei Ann, the woman she would portray on screen. Bullock said, "People use it, Christianity, as a banner, and then they don't do the right thing." She added, "They go, 'I'm a good Christian and I go to church, and this is the way you should live your life.' I said to Lei Ann when I met her, 'One of my biggest concerns stepping into this is the whole banner thing.' I told her it scared me because I've had a lot of experiences that haven't been that great. But she was so honest and forthright. Bullock concluded, I finally met someone who walks the walk, and that made me happy. Christianity is not, of course, about works. But when others can't see Jesus, what they think about Jesus and Christianity will often come from Christians. And what they see isn't always good, because none of us are perfect. But we have to remember who we are. If someone made a movie about your life or my life, I expect they would cast Daniel Craig to play me. What would the actor playing you or I conclude about those who follow Jesus? What would people think if they saw the movie? What they see won't be perfect, definitely not in my case, but none of us are. Still, it's an interesting question to ponder. Perhaps one of the best role models you will meet anywhere is Mike Pinball Clemens. Notwithstanding the fact that he played his entire professional football career with the Toronto Argonauts instead of my Tiger Cats. But all have sinned and fallen short. Regardless, Pinball is well known for his tireless charity work and simply for being one of the most moral and inspiring personalities you will ever meet. During his playing career in 1996, he won the Tom Pate Award, a Canadian Football League award to a player who is known for his sportsmanship and work in the community. In his televised acceptance speech, Pinball said, I'd like to thank my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who is really the reason I do the things I do. I act the way I act. I live the way I live. Pinball added, some people don't understand when people get up and thank someone who they can't see. But that is the biggest part of me and the biggest part of my life. I really am serious about it and really wanted to do that. As a Christian, Pinball is the real deal, and anyone who has ever met him, as I did when I was 11 years old, can attest to that. But as I said before, community is important in reinforcing what we believe and building us up. I would like to show you a clip from an American television series called Bull. It's a courtroom drama. In the story, a young woman named Gemma has disappeared and faced certain types of abuse and was coerced to do certain criminal activities and doesn't think she can possibly talk about her experiences in court. But in the clip, she learns that he is not alone, and the church plays a part in that.
I missed you so much. I'm sorry I wasn't there for you. You must have felt so alone.
It's so good to see you. It's so good to see everybody.
So what do you say? Tired of just surviving? Ready to put up a fight?
I think I am. I think I'm ready to testify.
Gemma received strength because of the church. This is what the church should be. The church can both inspire faith and threaten it when its members do not do as they should. But it's a community that should reinforce what is good. Now in Mark 9:19, Jesus told his faithless audience, how much longer must I put up with you? So before you all start saying that about this sermon, I will give you some concluding words. Faith is not always easy, and some doubt is normal. But when we deal with our doubts, when we get static, as with many things in life, we can keep turning back to the church and worship and remember that we are not alone, and also that questions are okay. But my challenge to you is this. Remember that for the world outside, what they see concerning Jesus will often come from Christians. And what do we show them? Thank you.
Single dream, I lay each one down at your feet. hands are